October 7th and since then. So I think we are some distance from that. And again, as you started out, I think the political will doesn't, it's not clear to me that it exists at this point. And
And
so
just a,
without that, yeah, go ahead.
no, just a final quick point about the law and accountability. You know, there are different cases that we will see progress over months and indeed years. One at the International Criminal Court, which is about war crimes targeted at individuals, and then there's the International Court of Justice considering genocide in the context of Gaza. Do those help or actually hinder getting to peace?
In theory, they should help, but in past conflicts, they also have often been quite divisive. And, you know, in theory, they would provide a common set of facts, but often, in fact, actors interpret the rulings as quite biased. And I would expect that to be the case here as well.
Scott Strauss, thank you so much for your insights. Thanks for joining us on The Times at One. That's it from me for today. Jane and Fia standing by, so do stay with us here on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Stephen. Good afternoon. 2 o'clock, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio until four.
Coming up on our programme today, key evidence in the China spying case is set to be released and the Home Secretary says Britain has lost control of its borders. We're going to hear from the Times political team about what's going on behind the scenes. We'll get the latest from both Israel and Gaza, including from a charity inside the Strip. Today is payday for the world's strongest military, but with the US government shutdown continuing, will it be able to find the cash? And our big interview after 3:30 is with the historical novelist Philippa Gregory on her latest book.
Let's get the news at 2. Tom Noonan.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Sir Starmer says the government will publish in full the evidence it submitted to prosecutors in the China spying case. The Crown Prosecution Service dropped charges against two men last month after saying the government failed to provide evidence China represented a national security threat. The Prime Minister told the House of Commons the National Security Advisor Jonathan Powell did not change the government's evidence at a meeting last month.
The final statement in this case was submitted in August 2025. There was no further submission of evidence, one way or the other, after any discussion in September. This is a red herring, a completely scurrilous allegation made by the Leader of the Opposition.
Ministers have said the position of the last government is what is relevant and have blamed the Conservatives for not acting soon enough to describe China as a threat. The Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch, insists, though, the fault is Labour's.
Mr Speaker, you deserve better and this House deserves better than the evasive answers that we have had from the Prime Minister. Even the former Cabinet Secretary, Lord Butler, has accused the government of being economical with the truth on this issue. The Prime Minister can't tell us why Jonathan Powell had a secret meeting which the Security Minister said he had no involvement in the case.
During Prime Minister's questions, both Ms Badenoch and the Housing Secretary, James Cleverly, accused the Prime Minister of misconstruing their past statements on China. Israel says one of the bodies returned by Hamas is not that of a hostage. The Israeli government has cut some aid deliveries to Gaza in response to delays in the terror group handing over the last 21 bodies. Shosh Bedrosian, a spokesperson for the Israeli Prime Minister, says Hamas should have returned all the dead bodies on Monday.
We will not compromise on this and we will spare no effort until our fallen hostages return, every last one of them. Hamas agreed to release all 48 of our hostages in phase one and made the specific confirmation to President Trump, and we are expecting to see the terror organization uphold their side of this agreement.
Hamas has asked for more time and the Red Cross has said returning the bodies will take time because of the rubble in Gaza. The Chancellor says the government is introducing sanctions to target the two biggest Russian oil companies. Rachel Reeves says the sanctions are focusing on companies in India and China, which are helping Russian oil access global markets. Angela Rayner has accepted almost £17,000 in severance pay despite voting to ban such payments. The former Housing Secretary and Deputy Prime Minister was forced to resign after underpaying stamp duty on her seaside flat in Hove by £40,000. Credit Suisse has lost a £325 million high court claim against the Japanese investment firm SoftBank Group. It's over a restructuring agreement involving the collapse of Lex Greensill's firm Greensill Capital, which supplied loans to Credit Suisse customers. And next year, London will become the first city in Europe to have driverless taxis. The Google-owned company Waymo will start operating in the coming weeks before a full launch in 2026. They already run robo-taxis in five US cities and in Tokyo. For news when you want it, you can search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It's 4 minutes past two. We say a big hello to Mike, who's one of our Times Radio listeners, who sent in a message a couple of minutes ago saying, at the risk of causing embarrassment, that was a compelling Times at One. Great stories and guests with a similarly great host. More of the same, please. Well, it never causes any embarrassment, Mike, at all. Keep those blushes coming, and we hope you enjoy our programme too. Greetings, people. We've made it to Wednesday. Our usual midweek things are in the programme today. Are you already hooked on celebrity traitors? Do you like to see very well-known people lying their way to the finish line? Of course it's all for charity. Well, we do, and we'll talk about that with Scott Bryan. Tech news today with Chris Stokel-Walker. ChatGPT will soon be allowing verified users to ask it for a little bit of erotica. That didn't take very long, did it? And a bit like the saying that you're never more than 9 foot from a rat in a city, it would seem that you're never more than two clicks from a bit of human excitement on any given digital platform. We have big news for you today, of course, and we will look ahead to what might happen in Gaza once charities can really move in there. We're going to start as well with a look at PMQs with our very own favourite Times political brain, that's Oliver Wright. We're going to talk to Lara Spirit about that US government shutdown again. And this one is a really, well, it's a very imperative day because the military are meant to be being paid. And if there isn't enough money in the coffers, they've got to find it from somewhere. So the Pentagon has looked to some research programs in order to clear out some dollar bills and change. And after 3:30, we go back in time.
We do, to Philippa Gregory's latest historical novel, already a smash hit. It's called Berlin Traitor. Yes, we are back in the world of intrigue, deceit, jiggery-pokery, and much, much worse. Henry VIII is very much on the throne, although he has passed his best. He had a jousting accident. Are you familiar with his jousting accident?
Well, is it the one that rendered him incapable of getting upstairs? So he had to have a system of pulleys at Hampton Court.
He wasn't in his virile pomp, but he didn't recognise it. It's uncanny in some ways. There are parallels to contemporary leaders. I don't know who I'm thinking of. Perhaps somebody with reddish hair who stands astride the planet. Henry VIII, back though in the 16th century here in this country, Jane Boleyn went to court as a 12-year-old girl. She married a man called George Boleyn, who was the brother of Anne Boleyn. Keep up. But somehow Jane Boleyn survived the beheading of her sister-in-law, kept her job at court, in fact, went on to serve various other wives of Henry VIII. The big puzzle is how? What did she know? Who was she working for?
She was a canny Jane.
She was a very canny Jane operator back at the court of Henry VIII. It didn't end well for Jane Boleyn, but you'll find out more in the company of Philippa Gregory, after 3:30.
Would you like to tell us about the most read stories on The Times today?
Yes, I think we'll start. Let's start with the most read piece on The Times website today. It's the Oxford student who led Put Zios in the Ground chant. He's been suspended. He is called Samuel Williams. He's a Balliol College student, and he was seen on video calling for Gaza to, quotes, make us proud. The second most read story, Rachel Reeves, budget may include both tax rises and spending cuts. It's the first time the Chancellor has admitted that tax rises are being considered. She is, of course, desperate to fill that estimated £30 billion black hole in the public finances. And we'll talk about that in a sec. And at number three, Trump blasts Time magazine cover as the worst of all time. Thin-skinned US President Donald took to his Truth Social network to criticise the photo of him adorning the cover of Time.
Because that's what's important at the moment, Jane.
Yes. He accused the mag of disappearing his hair. and said the picture was taken at a bad angle. Do you know, for the first time, I'm about to express a bit of sympathy for Donald Trump. I see what he means here. This is very much not his best side. It's taken looking up at...
It's really odd. You have to try and imagine where the cameraman or woman was when they took the picture.
But they're well exposed to all of his chins. And there's not a lot else going on, to be honest. I mean, I love the idea of his hair being disappeared. I suspect his hair puts on its pyjamas and settles down for a sleep.
In a separate room
to the man himself. But who knows? Anyway, look, but we're all vain, let's be honest. It's very easy for me to mock the man, but honestly, nobody likes a bad picture.
Well, they don't, Jane, but it's not what's important at the moment.
Well, it's important to him.
In this week of weeks. Where should people go if they want to form a very close personal relationship with these stories?
You know what? It really helps if you are a subscriber to The Times. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe. And that's not all. If you are a digital subscriber, you've got access to a whole range of newsletters, including the brilliant Politics newsletter. It is delivered straight to your inbox each and every morning. And to sign up, just log in to your Times account and head to the My Newsletters section.
Let's turn our attention to politics back home. Keir Starmer says he'll publish evidence from the China spy case after repeated accusations that his government collapsed the trial.
After legal advice, I have decided to publish the witness statement. Given the information contained, we will conduct a short process, but I want to make clear I intend to publish the witness statements in full. Let me say this, to be clear. Had the Conservatives been quicker in updating our legislation, a review that started in 2015, these individuals could have been prosecuted and we would not be where we are without.
Well, that's the Prime Minister speaking at PMQs as his government faces sustained pressure on several fronts. The Home Secretary will today admit that the UK has lost control over its borders, while the Chancellor says both tax rises and spending cuts are being considered at the upcoming budget. Oliver Wright is policy editor for The Times. It is always good to talk to you, Oliver. Something of a barnstorming performance by Kemi Badenoch today, leading on the China spy case. That's where we're going to start. So let's hear her first question.
It is simply unbelievable that he is trying to say the last government did not classify China as a threat. So I will refresh his memory. In 2021, the previous government's integrated review described China as the biggest state-based threat to the UK's economic security. In 2024, the Minister for Security said from that dispatch box that China poses a threat. But let's leave aside the government. In 2022, the Director General of MI5 in November classified China as a threat in his remarks. How is it possible that the government failed to provide the evidence that the CPS needed to prosecute?
Well, that's Kemi Badenoch, and we'll talk more about her performance at PMQs. But, Oliver, I think many people are starting to feel a little bit lost in the weeds of the detail of this case. So what's the important thing that we might be about to learn? It's all in the witness statements, isn't it?
It is all in the witness statements. And, I think people would be right to feel that the whole thing is enormously complicated. But the key point...
Oh, now we've lost him. Do you know what? Sometimes that happens when we're talking about China. It's very odd. No, he's back. He's back. You're back. Are you back, Ollie?
I am back.
Oh, okay. We can now. Could you spool back and actually just answer the question again? Because we lost you very soon into it.
Sure. The critical point here is that Starmer has said he is going to publish a statement from the Deputy National Security Advisor, a guy called Matt Collins. Now, this statement matters because it's right at the centre of why the case collapsed. Collins was supposed to say that China was a threat to Britain's national security, but this statement, from what we're told, doesn't say that. So what we're interested in is what it says, how far it goes, and whether the government is right or whether the Crown Prosecution Service is right, because at the same time, there is this extraordinary blame game going on between the government and the Crown Prosecution Service over who exactly is responsible for the crashing of this case.
Okay, and the opposition, we heard very clearly there, is implying that, being weak on China is the problem. And the Prime Minister had quite a careful statement. So let's listen to this.
What was an issue in the trial is not the position of the current government, the position of the last government. And they carefully avoided describing China as an enemy because that was their policy at the time. Mr. Speaker, so far as the position under this government is concerned, no minister or special advisor was involved. And I will double check this because I've had it. I will double check this. So, Mr. Speaker, this is important. After the charging decision, the prosecution were very careful about who would then see the witness evidence. I will double check, Mr. Speaker, exactly what instruction was taken. But my answer, I can be absolutely clear, no minister was involved, no special advisor was involved in this, and I'm assured as I can be that the prosecution was saying that it would be the witnesses only that were involved in short updates the evidence that was submitted under the last government.
Right, once a lawyer, always a lawyer. There's a little phrase in there, Ollie, I'm as assured as I can be. Should we be hanging on to that one just in case something does now turn up that reeks of Keir Starmer not knowing the right thing at the right time?
Yeah, wasn't that a lawyerly response? Yeah, exactly. I mean, he is covering himself because the most difficult thing in this is giving a statement that turns out to be misleading to Parliament. And, you know, clearly the fact that Starmer chose those form of words means that he is not entirely certain in what he's saying to MPs. And I think this is, you know, this goes to the heart of it. It's a real problem for the government. You know, they are facing these increasing claims that ministers had some kind of involvement in this, that they wanted to preserve their relationship with China, and as a consequence of which, they were very happy for this case to drop. Now, they deny that, but I think, you know, over the coming days, we'll find out a much more accurate picture of exactly who knew what in government and when.
Can we talk a little bit about Kemi Badenoch? Because many people said that she really delivered at conference and that there was just a little something else about her, something more relaxed, something more confident, something, you know, better able to really show herself well. Do you agree with that? And has PMQs today confirmed that?
Yeah, I do think there has been a change. I think she was really buoyed by that conference speech last week. You know, she felt it went well. She felt that the big main policy on stamp duty landed well. And, you know, in politics, a lot is about confidence. And, you know, it's easy for us to sort of sit there and judge PMQs. But, you know, you talk to anyone who's done it, and it is a pretty scary experience. You've got to be very fast on your feet. You've got people shouting all around you, and you get blamed if you don't perform as well as they think you should. And you get blamed by your own side. And Kemi Badenoch certainly got quite criticized for a long period of time by our own MPs for her performance. So I think there is a change. I think, you know, coming off the back of what, you know, she thought was widely regarded to be a successful conference, you know, you've got a bit of mojo. And obviously, you know, the China spy case is one where the Conservatives think they've got a good case to prosecute against the government. And, you know, I think that shows.
Yeah, but a strong and well-led opposition is good for democracy. It's good for everybody, isn't it? Can we talk a little bit about stuff happening elsewhere? So the Home Secretary about to say that we've lost control of our borders. As the party in government, why say that, Oliver?
Very, very good. Very good question. I think, you know, she is merely articulating what most, you know, voters who are at the moment saying, you know, we're going to vote for reform are feeling. I think, you know, Shabana Mahmood's whole strategy in this is to come in here and saying, I'm a fresh broom. I'm going to get on top of this. I know you're angry of what's going on, but, you know, believe me, I'm going to get this sorted. And this really is the sort of first step. It's almost like the kind of mea culpa before you go on and say, well, this is what I'm going to do, and judge me by my actions, not what's gone before me. But obviously, you know, it's a risk. You know, she's saying we've lost control of our borders, and I can easily see that being repeated back to her in a year or two's time if the government doesn't make progress on this critical issue.
She's hosting a summit of Balkan nations. What's she hoping to achieve there?
It's all about returns agreements. It's all about cooperation. This is the big issue for the government. How do you get people from, say, countries like Albania who've come to the UK back, and how do you stop people?
Ah, we've had another little loss.
Coming into the European Union, who then may come onto the UK. Sorry. And then, you know, the other element to this is they're very keen to set up return hubs. So, i.e., someone comes to the UK, they're not allowed to stay in the UK, they get sent to a third country where they get processed. And that's one of the big aims of the government.
We were talking yesterday about the absolute impossibility of not feeling a bit doom-laden ahead of the budget, Oliver. And here comes today an uncomfortable statement of the obvious, which is not going to help our mood, from Rachel Reeves. Oh, well, yes, it's coming now.
Come on, Rachel.
No, I don't think it is.
Nobody wants to hear it.
Challenges are always thrown our way, but I won't duck those challenges. Of course, we're looking at tax and spending as well, but the numbers will always add up with me as Chancellor.
OK, we're looking at tax and spending as well is the key thing that we needed to take from that. Any thoughts, Oliver, that might be more optimistic or more pessimistic than when we spoke yesterday?
No, I think we're still firmly in the pessimism camp here. You know, what we've said today, which I thought was interesting, is that, you know, as you said, they are looking at spending as well as taxation. And that suggests possibly they're going to revisit welfare. Now, part of the reason Reeves is in such a mess is that the government was forced to drop £5 billion worth of welfare reforms that would have saved them very, very large amounts of money. Now, the question is the budget going to go back and try and claw some of that back? Now, that's going to be hugely controversial with Labour backbenchers. I would have thought when the Office of Budget Responsibility, who go through the Treasury's numbers, look at it, they'll be very sceptical of anything that the government says about welfare reform. But, you know, that was a clear signal from Reeves that in order to fill the black hole, she's not just going to have to do stuff on tax, but she's also going to have to do stuff on spending as well.
Oliver, good to talk to you. I'm sorry that we lost you from time to time, but good recoveries both times. Oliver Wright is policy editor for The Times.
Now, next, we are heading to Cheltenham to the Literature Festival to get the very latest, hear all about today's events. And we're asking, which literary character would you most like to be stranded on a desert island with? Have a little ponder. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Ed Vasey on Times Radio, reviewing the week in politics from Westminster and beyond.
This is the kind of most interesting thing, I guess, about what is going on in British politics at the moment.
The daily political debrief with a difference.
Oh no, more crypto-commie pro-Labour Vasey.
Plus a peerless lineup of guests and commentators.
He, like me, and indeed like most of our listeners, is a bit of a political junkie.
Ed Vasey, every Friday morning from 10 on Times Radio.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on 2024 UK and EU Amazon packaging data.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
Ever wondered what power is? Power is transforming the sun into your own energy source. Power is getting energy companies to pay you. Power is enjoying your morning coffee, knowing you created the energy to make it. Well, you and the colossal ball of fire in the sky. Because with solar panels from Hive, the sun works for you. Hive, know your power. May not cover all electricity usage, roof and weather dependent. Paid for surplus requires eligible SET tariff.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
If you were stranded on a desert island, which character from a book would you choose as your companion? That's just one of the questions being pondered later on today at the Times and Sunday Times Cheltenham Literature Festival. Now, I have been told that there is what we call a delay on the line to Cheltenham. This is because we are thousands of miles away in the centre of London, just very, very close to the River Thames with dazzling views of the fantastic city skyline. I wonder if they can hear us in Cheltenham now. Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Rosie Wright in Cheltenham?
Yes, I can. And let's hope there will not be a delay when you're here in person tomorrow.
Thank you for mentioning that, Rosie. We are there. That's absolutely right. With a show between 3:30 and 4:30. That's the final half hour there, exclusive to people who've actually gone to Cheltenham. And we're in conversation with Penny Lancaster. So very much looking forward to that. But let's go back to the topic of today, Rosie. And who would you choose from literature to keep you company on a desert island?
I know, I've been searching for some inspiration from the people who've attended Cheltenham today, some of the writers, authors, and we've had some slightly cliche responses maybe, like William Shakespeare. I think that was an author who was actually just keen to sort of grapple with some of Shakespeare's ideas.
Yeah.
Some people have gone a bit more practical, yeah. So I don't know what you think about George from the Famous Five.
Right.
Joan March, I thought, was a good suggestion from Little Women.
Mm-hmm.
Katniss Everdeen from The Hunger Games, because she'd be very practical.
But
of the sort of Cheltenham literature ladies were saying she'd be a bit boring. So maybe you'd go for her partner in crime, Peter. I suggested Elizabeth Bennet because I think she'd be a bit of a good time. But that answer was sort of rather rubbished as well. So I think you want someone practical, capable and also interesting.
Well, I, in the end, having rummaged through what's left of my brain, I came up with Nancy Blackett from Swallows and Amazons. But that's very much in the of practical use kind of department. But I'm not even sure.
Yes.
That would that name mean anything to you, Rosie?
Do you know what? That is the risk with asking people questions like this, where I'm in a very well-read audience and I often have to sort of just laugh along and pretend I know. So I'm not going to disclose if Nancy was in that category or not.
All right. But it is interesting that most people go for a bit of sparkling wit and an ability with a hammer and some string. I mean, because in the end, that's what you're going to... If you are going to be stranded with someone, you don't want to be bored. But on the other hand, you do want someone who could perhaps get the... Well, get some sort of sluice arrangement up and working, because it could be a long old haul on that desert island. So tell us about the biographer Rachel Trethewey. I think she's been speaking to you about who she would choose. Here she is.
Uncle Matthew, the Mitford girl's father. And it's Lord Reedsdale, really, personified in Nancy Mitford's books, The Pursuit of Love and Love in a Cold Climate. And so it's 80 years since Nancy brought out the first portrayal of Uncle Matthew. And he's this blustering, hilarious, furious character who hunts down his children with bloodhounds, says outrageous things about damn sewers, and hates abroad and anyone who's foreign. So he's certainly not politically correct, but on a desert island, I really think he'd come into his own.
Well, I don't know. It does depend how long you'd be stranded.
Another example.
Go on.
Yes, well, I had to do a little bit of Googling to work out who he was. Of course, we all know about the Mitford sisters, the notorious girls. And being one of four myself, I do sort of have empathy with the men in our lives, let's say our dads, who are very good at gluing things back together, being a practical number to call at the other end of the phone. So I think she's along the right lines of saying maybe the father of many girls would be someone quite useful on a desert island. But it's been really interesting. She's sort of been delving into what it was like to raise such sort of notorious siblings. You know, one of them turned out to be a Nazi, another a socialist. So that's one of the topics up for debate a little bit later this afternoon.
Yes, and Rachel's latest book, we should say, is called Muv, the story of the Mitford girl's mother. Tell us a little bit about the atmosphere there today, Rosie. I can hear that familiar Cheltenham bustle there in the background.
Yeah, it's pretty cold, actually. So there's a bit of bustling around me. But the stadiums, the town hall where we had Prime Minister's questions unpacked, absolutely heaving. Lots of laughter. People are in very good spirits. There were lots of sort of debates about that conversation we've just been having about who you'd like to be cast away with over lunch, which has been brilliant. But there's also, if you're into the sort of more zen away from the buzz, just as I was walking through here, there's the hush zone where you can take part in a sound bath, which I'm not sure I'd be taking part in, but you could do. There's also also every afternoon from 5 till 6, there's the Times are running a wine tasting that's free, you can turn up on. So there's sort of a flavour of everything. And I know you've also been talking about the economy in some detail today for obvious reasons. If you fancy, and I think... I can say this truthfully because the person who's organising the festival said this to me. You know when you get a group of people and they think, I'm an expert, I think I could give a go at that.
Yeah.
What about being the Chancellor? I think the people attending Cheltenham feel like maybe they could have a go at that. This afternoon, could you run the economy? Would you fancy being Rachel Reeves, what, in Washington today, grappling what the IMF had to say? Imagine the session happening right now as I speak. You've just become Chancellor of the Exchequer, one of those powerful people in prison. In Britain, the stakes are high. What would you do? And based on what decisions you might make, how much peril might you cause? Jo Mays, who's, of course, brilliant from Bloomberg, is in conversation with our very own Patrick Maguire as we speak, speaking to an audience at Cheltenham who I think feel like they might fancy throwing their hat into the ring and run the economy.
Well, I don't have a hat, but if I did, I wouldn't want to throw it into that ring. I couldn't think of a tougher challenge.
Nor me.
No, I mean, that is properly tough. Rosie, thank you very much. Are you seeing anything later, attending an event, apart from the one you mentioned with Patrick?
I'm running around doing an awful lot of interviews for Times Radio and squeezing in what I can in between. And what is actually so nice is just seeing so many Times Radio voices that you will also, of course, be super familiar with, particularly because I'm on so early in the morning, 5 till 6. There's some people I've sort of only ever see and never see and hear, right. Sorry, never see in person. So I'm meeting as many of them as possible as well.
Well, enjoy it, Rosie. Thank you very much indeed. That's Rosie Wright reporting from that festival in Cheltenham, the Literature Festival. We'll be there tomorrow. Very much looking forward to it. We've had some emails to the podcast, haven't we, from people who say they're coming along tomorrow. So do come and say hello.
Yes, please do. We start at 3:30. I think we're in the Forum, aren't we?
Yeah, but we are doing our show as normal from a specially roped-off area.
We are. So wear sensible shoes, because then we've got to run from the roped-off area all the way to the Forum. Let's not be out of breath.
No.
If I was Chancellor, I'd tax facial hair, alternative milk and pets. Coming up, the Trump administration will use funds previously intended for research to pay military troops because the federal government shutdown is continuing. It's just gone 3:30. You're listening to Fee and Jane. Here's the news with Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer says the government will publish its evidence to the China spying case in full. The case collapsed when the Crown Prosecution Service dropped charges against two men, saying the government had failed to provide sufficient evidence of the threat posed by China. Sir David Calvert-Smith is a former director of public prosecutions in England and Wales. He told Times Radio how it will be decided what to redact from the published evidence.
You would then wish to take the opinions of those more closely concerned with the facts, in case there was some particularly sensitive material which you hadn't spotted, but which they wish to argue should not be placed in the public domain. That's the sort of discussion that goes on frequently, though, of course, not often in the sort of high-profile way that this case is going.
Israel says one of the four bodies handed over by Hamas last night is not that of one of the hostages. Israel has cut the number of aid deliveries into Gaza in response to delays in Hamas handing over the bodies. The terror group says it needs more time. Rachel Reeves is again considering cutting the cash ISA allowance for savers in her budget next month. The Chancellor wants to get savers investing more of their money, but shelved plans to cut the £20,000 limit in July after a backlash from banks and building societies. And a village in Dartmoor has had its potholes filled in, not by the local council, but by the film crew for the new Harry Potter series. Residents in Lusley in Devon have questioned why it took HBO to pay for the repairs. Cuts to local highway budgets have seen a sharp decline in pothole repairs in recent decades. Don't forget, you can set the Times news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
You want work to be less hard work. You hear an ad for MHR, so you reach out. We connect your department systems, which leads to real-time data sharing that uncovers new insights, which empower your decision-makers and triple monthly sales, which leads to high fives and awkward hugs. You say a big thank you. We say you're welcome. MHR, the science behind HR, payroll and finance. The science behind a new world of work. Discover more at mhrglobal.com.
Here's to the moment. To the places that give you perspective,
and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silversea brings you closer to the rare, the remote, and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate. To finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Nobody asks to have a lifetime of memories slowly erased. Nobody asks to have a loved one not recognize them. Nobody asks to feel lonely and confused. But today, you could change this. By leaving a gift in your will to Alzheimer's Society, you'll help fund life-changing support, vital campaigning, and groundbreaking research to tackle Britain's biggest killer. Discover the impact your gift can make. Search Alzheimer's Society Wills.
Get ahead of the news with Kate Borsay from 7pm as she brings you Tomorrow's Times Today, an exclusive look at the stories making tomorrow's headlines.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wix, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
John Pienaar takes over from us at 4 o'clock, just before we get to what he's got in the programme. Kat, I did say pets, and I've gone rogue, and I apologise for it. Hello, John. What's happening on your show?
Hello. So, lots and lots on the spying for China controversy. And I completely get there will be a lot of people who think that this was a spy trial years ago. It collapsed. There's a row which may seem academic about whether or not it should have collapsed, or whether or not the government had a role in this. But I think at this moment now today, we're looking at a controversy, and it's not going too far to say that Keir Starmer's scalp as Prime Minister is on the line. He has now stood up in the House of Commons. He's accused Kemi Badenoch of confecting this out of nowhere for purely political reasons, accused of playing fast and loose with the issue of national security. If he cannot satisfy, or at the very least withstand, the accusation that he and his government somehow nobbled a security trial at the in our courts for political reasons and then covered it up, because that was Kemi Badenoch's accusation today. If he can't sort of weather that, then he's finished. And more than that, on the threat from China, there's a story now leading the Times. It's literally just popped up in the last few moments. A Stephen Swinford exclusive. We've been talking to Dominic Cummings. And Dominic Cummings' tale in that story is that China had been getting into the most secret databases in Whitehall, and for years. So, and dangerous material, which, if compromised, would pose a very, very clear and immediate threat to national security in this country. And as I say, doing it for years. And that bears very directly on the question of the wrangle about whether or not China, and when China was deemed a threat. So the story just keeps on escalating.
If Dominic Cummings knew about that, then that means the previous Conservative government knew about
that. So Dominic Cummings, and look at the story in the front of the Times, he's saying there that the news was given to him, to the Prime Minister at the time, which was Boris Johnson, and eyebrows shot up. People thought, what on earth are we being told? And right after that, the head of the civil service effectively, you know, came in and said, no one can breathe a word about this. And if anyone does, they're going to face criminal prosecution. So, you know, layers and layers are being torn off this story, and it moves as we speak, while we wait for this piece of testimony from a previously absolutely obscure figure in Whitehall, now almost famous, the Deputy National Security Advisor, who gave testimony to the Spying for China case. And Keir Starmer is saying, because he's had to say, it's going to be published. Yeah. There's a lot riding on that too.
And he used this very clever little phrase, didn't he, at PMQs, I'm as assured as I can be, which I don't know about anybody else, but that just doesn't reek of absolute certainty.
Yeah, I mean, look, Keir Starmer he's a lawyer. I mean, sometimes he looks a lot more like a lawyer than a politician, doesn't he? And his confidence in question time suggests that he thinks he can sustain this case. He thinks he can come through this. Otherwise, it was a very convincing show of confidence. So we'll see what that testimony, the witness statement of the National Deputy Security Advisor actually says. Does it nail the issue? Does it leave it open? Are we going to end up in, you know, going from one great big grey area of disputed accounts into another grey area of disputed accounts? That's not unlikely by the way. And I'm going to be talking to, well, I'm talking to, looking for, talk to Stephen Swinford about the story he's just broken in the Times. I'm going to be talking to politicians, going to be talking to people, everyone I can get my hands on, basically, over the course of the next couple of hours.
John, thank you. So John starts at 4 o'clock, goes through until 7. Let's turn our attention to America for the next couple of minutes. The Pentagon is redirecting billions of dollars from research programs to pay military troops as the US government shutdown enters its third week. With Democrats and Republicans still deadlocked over the federal budget, the Trump administration has been laying off workers across several government agencies. The Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, has warned that the shutdown is now beginning to hit the real economy. Let's talk to Lara Spirit, Washington correspondent for The Times. A very good afternoon from us in London, Lara. Which is the first part of this huge economy that this will hit and hurt?
Well, exactly. That is the big question at the moment. Clearly, there are many areas on which people like Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, will be very worried about. Traditionally, although it affects billions and billions of spending in the government, there's tended to be not massive economic effects from government shutdowns. But with Mike Johnson, the Speaker, warning that this could be the longest shutdown in US history if it continues, and there does still seem to be absolutely no sign of a resolution, you are looking at some economic effects. If you look at, for example, tourism, many people will be looking at the current reports about airport delays, for example, and be weighing up whether or not they want to travel to the US at a time like this. They will be hoping that they can still continue to protect, as you say, payment for those who work for the military. And we have seen from the Pentagon today a statement saying that they've managed to move $8 billion from research and other areas into the payroll. Not totally clear if that's legal, but it looks unlikely that anybody is going to question that at the moment, given how necessary this is going to be for many of those workers. But the longer term effects to the economy of many of these places being shuttered, agencies being unable to deliver their work will be lasting.
Lara, by sheer happenstance and coincidence, Scott Bessent is actually talking now at the IMF conference. So let's just have a listen in.
They buy 90% of Iranian energy. So who is fueling the Russian war machine? We will be producing photos soon, supplied to us by the Ukrainian government, that shows Chinese parts comprise substantial amounts of Ukrainian drones. So President Trump is the leader of peace. We should work together to de-risk and diversify. China's highly provocative move comes after we've made significant efforts to de-escalate.
Well, I think actually we'll leave that there. And we think he probably meant Russian drones, not Ukrainian drones, just in case you're thinking, God, that would be a certain development. We'll listen across that for you. And if anything else really relevant and newsworthy is going to be said, then we'll clip it and bring it to you. So, Lara, back to these problems over this extraordinary shutdown. And it could be extraordinary, couldn't it? Because, as you said, it looks like it might go on for much longer than previous shutdown adjacent situations. And surely so much of this is political. It's a chance for the Democrats to show what they're made of, to try and hold the Republican administration to account. So what is your assessment of the future of this?
Well, the assessment at the moment is it's very hard to see how there's going to be any imminent breakthrough. So we've had 8 votes now to advance legislation to try and reopen the government through to mid-November. The last one failed by 49 votes to 45. Now you need 60. There's no headway being made by either Republicans or Democrats to move the dial on that vote count at all. So Republicans still quite some way off. But you're hearing from the White House Office of Management and Budget, for example, who wrote yesterday that the administration is making every preparation to try and ride out this shutdown without caving to any of the demands from the Democrats. They said they're going to, in the meantime, continue making cuts to the federal workforce, which, of course, they will hope will try and bring some more Democrats who are worried about permanent changes to the federal workforce and job losses to the table. But at the moment, it's not clear that that's happening. And in the meantime, you have, you know, as we've spoken about, massive delays at air traffic control, for example. You do have impacts to the economy. And I don't mean to diminish that. So the Congressional Budget Office estimated that in 2018 to 2019, the impact on the economy was 0.02% of GDP. Now, that doesn't sound massive, but it is still obviously significant. And given that they are warning that this could be the longest one that we've ever seen, and given that it's very hard to see any breakthrough now, it is clearly very significant that there is still no real indication of how they're going to solve this shutdown and reopen the government.
And obviously just incredibly difficult for those employees who are in literally the firing line at the moment. So how much noise can be made on their behalf?
Well, it's a very good point. And I think that at the moment, Democrats have a messaging question because they want to keep the shutdown focused on healthcare. There was a big question in Democrat circles at the beginning of this shutdown. You know, do we focus the shutdown on saying on questions around democracy and rights that they want to talk about with regards to the Trump administration, deportations that they also want to talk about? Or do we focus something on something more bread and butter and more specific? And to their mind, the expiration of these healthcare credits and cuts to Medicaid, for example, should be chief of people's minds. And so they focus very doggedly, actually, on this question of healthcare during the shutdown, as a result of which I don't think they're necessarily going to focus as much on talking about federal workers, not least because Republicans wager that from their perspective, at least, federal workers might not make up a massively significant portion of their voter base. And I think this question about whether or not Democrats can keep the shutdown focus on healthcare will be a big determinant of how long this lasts. And for that reason, I think the conversation isn't really necessarily about those who are losing or at threat of losing their job. There is a big conversation about getting the military pay, as we've just mentioned, with regard to the Pentagon. There is also a big question about those who are legally obliged to continue working without pay. I think key among them, of course, those air traffic controllers and those who work in airports, not least because they're seeing an uptick, we've heard from the Transport Secretary here, in those who are calling in sick, and because the kind of major shutdown that is cited here in the US, the one that ran from the winter of 2018 through to the beginning of 2019, ended in part really because of the impact on flights and air traffic control, and the fact that Trump reopened the government after there were some really, really serious delays for people at airports, particularly in New York's LaGuardia Airport, which was temporarily shut down in January 2019. So that is very significant because they can't they can't not go to work. They're legally obliged to. But clearly you're seeing significant delays in a number of airports across the country now. And that will be, I think, kind of top of the agenda in the shutdown conversation over the coming weeks.
And I have to say, Lara, I mean, if you are of the nervous disposition as a traveller, you shouldn't go anywhere near any of the articles that are detailing exactly what's happening in air traffic control at the moment, because, you know, they are frightening in some airports, you know, 40% down on staffing. But the airports are still determined to carry on letting planes come into land and take off. So I'm just saying, don't go there.
Happy holidays.
Lara, thank you very much indeed. Always good to talk to you. That's Lara Spirit, Washington correspondent for The Times.
It's absolutely terrifying.
It is terrifying, actually, Jane. So, you know, I mean, you can inform yourself, obviously. I'm not telling you not to inform yourself. But presumably there is still quite a strong attitude towards safety. When you look at the statistics, you think, I hope that is the case.
Yes, I think we can all very much agree on that. OK, now it's a big night tonight in most households because it is the return of Celebrity Traitors. Now, I think some of us thought it was going to be on perhaps three or four nights a week.
It's only two.
It's two, isn't it? It's Wednesday and Thursday and there are nine episodes altogether. So it's episode three tonight at 9 o'clock and we're going to be talking to Britain's leading TV critic, Scott Bryan. He'll try and assess who exactly could be banished from the Celebrity Traitor's Castle tonight. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The Evening Edition with Kate Borse on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Embark on an evening expedition, rounding up the latest news and previewing tomorrow's headlines. Plus, don't miss Hit the Road, your essential weekly travel guide to the best destinations across the UK and beyond. Every Monday to Thursday night from 7 on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California campervan. Designed for every adventure. Search new Volkswagen California to find out more.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Cabbage! Cabbage!
Buster, Coco, Max, all socially acceptable dog names, but you thought...
Cabbage!
...was the one, and now you're stuck with it. Turning heads as you march through the park in your aviator jacket.
Where are you, Cabbage?
Now, this could be embarrassing, but the cream shearling shields you from any ounce of shame. That chocolate brown trim makes losing your dog a fashion statement. If only you could lose the name.
Cabbage!
Whatever happens, style it out. F&F.
You want work to be less hard work. You hear an ad for MHR, so you reach out. We connect your department systems, which leads to real-time data sharing that uncovers new insights, which empower your decision makers and triple monthly sales, which leads to high fives and awkward hugs. You say a big thank you. We say you're welcome. MHR, the science behind HR, payroll and finance. The science behind a new world of work. Discover more at mhrglobal.com.
This year, Amazon are increasing the electric delivery vehicles we use across Europe to 10,000. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where babies are made a fuss of. Aww. Where we deliver footballs for kids' kickabouts, and where they deliver the football straight into next door's garden. Can they have their ball back, please? We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Delivery service partner vehicles across the UK and EU.
You never forget the dogs you've loved. They have the power to steal our hearts, to love us unconditionally, and be there for us when we need them most, without saying a word. You understand how a dog can change a life. A guide dog can transform the life of someone living with sight loss. Will you help change someone else's life with a gift in your will to guide dogs? Request our free will guide today. Search Guide Dogs Free Wills.
Guide Dogs. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
We're going to talk telly and in particular celebrity traitors with our favourite critic, Scott Bryan. But just to bear in mind, Matthew, who's WhatsApp to say, do not give any spoilers for traitors. I haven't seen episode 2. Right. Well, we'll do our best. I'm not sure how we're going to do this, to be honest,
Scott.
Well,
I think we might just have to ask Matthew if he could turn his radio down for the next 4 minutes.
Turn the knob down for a couple of minutes, Matthew, because we'll deal with traitors first of all. Welcome, Scott. How are you?
I'm good. I mean, yes, this is a bit of a nightmare, isn't it? Because I once got criticised for talking about a storyline from a show from 2018, and then someone messaged in to say, spoiler, and I was like, it was 7 years ago, yeah. Let me live.
Get a grip. I agree with you. Okay, now, I think a lot of people, for some good reasons, have a lot of fondness for Kate Garraway. I mean, heaven knows, the woman's been through a lot. She is currently taking part in Celebrity Traitors, and she is getting some criticism of what some people are describing as hamming. My view of this would be that she signed up to what she knows is an entertainment show and she's giving us entertainment. What do you think?
I mean, I think it's certainly down to the fact that it highlights to me how the other celebrities in this show, where there are no clues or very few clues, literally are just sort of picking up straws and just basically throwing anything that they can because they don't really have any information to know who really is a traitor. So I think that's the reason why this show has always, I think, been such a fascinating look at the human condition, because you're able to see kind of how psychology works and also how kind of persuasion works, because all it takes is one person around the round table to be like, oh, that person acted a little bit weird in this context. And then people to just jump to a conclusion and say, oh, yes, that is because they are a traitor, rather than that is a reflection of their personality. I mean, for me, nothing will beat last week when Tom Daley, the Olympian, sort of commented about how who uses the word flabbergasted was his comment that Kate had said. And then it was Alan who said, you can't think someone is a traitor just because they've got a better vocabulary than you.
Yes, I like that. yes, I think, I mean, it's a perfectly reasonable point, Alan. Point well made. What are we to make of the fact that Jonathan Ross posted on X yesterday, sharing that he didn't really enjoy the experience because he found constant lying uncomfortable? Well,
Yeah, I mean, he must have known he was going to be required to lie up to a point when he signed the contract to be on the show.
I mean, it is the game.
Yes.
That is literally it. I think it's also the fact that you do get that sense of guilt, and it always comes through with any series of The Traitors, is that you have the person who is very full of pride in episode one, firing, you know, sending people home essentially, or murdering them. And then by about episode six, episode seven, they are getting that guilt and it is being ramped up and it does feel rather real for them. But then they are also remembering that they are very much playing a part here. And I think that is certainly the case for Jonathan. I think what is interesting, I find, about this celebrity series is that when you're dealing with members of the public, you know, members of the public don't really know each other. Mm. And it takes a little while. So you can kind of murder people without really getting guilty, I think, to start off with, because you're like, oh, that person is, you know, possibly a threat. I think by the time you get to, you know, episode sort of eight or nine, and you can really sense a bond, you know, that changes. But with the celebrity series, they all know each other from the off. And I think that's why, even though, of course, you know, Alan's been making fun of it about Paloma, like the guilt was there and from the off, because everybody knew her and liked her. And I think that very much changes the dynamic. And I think it makes it all the more interesting than the civilian series. I think so far there's a bit more camaraderie between everyone than the most recent celebrity series. But also just that dynamic changes between sort of guilt and also wanting to win, because all celebrities are competitive. We all know that.
Well, yes. I wonder whether it'll make the civilian edition perhaps seem a bit tame, and perhaps it won't be as popular. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think what is to the BBC's benefit is the fact that the civilian series is on in January, and there is literally nothing else in January. I feel that ITV have pretty much given up showing anything up against in the schedules.
Fair enough.
During that time of year, I think also shows develop and change as they go. And I think, you know, possibly to its detriment, you know, as each series continues, the contestants who enter become more wise up to the format. So you have to try to evolve the show to not let it just slip into something that has happened before. I think Studio Lambert, who make the show, are very good at knowing how to do reality TV, and I think have evolved the show in some way with each series. But that is the biggest challenge, as well as kind of fatigue generally, of keeping people glued, is how do you try to evolve the show when the contestants are doing the same thing at the same time?
I do think with the civilian one, Scott, we really like to assume kind of ownership of new people, don't we? So I think it will be absolutely fine, because it makes celebrities of ordinary people. And I've put ordinary in inverted commas there, but nobody can tell because it's the radio. So I think we will still want to watch it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I also love the quote. I think I saw it outside a coffee shop that Alan Carr shared on his Instagram the other day, that said, Linda could walk, of course, a contestant from the most recent series. Linda could walk so Alan could run, which I think sums him up very much as being a traitor, to be honest.
Fantastic. Now, one of my WhatsApp groups has just simply gone berserk this week for Riot Women. This is Sally Wainwright's new punk drama on the iPlayer. And it's got some amazing actresses in it, actually. Joanna Scanlon, Tamsin Gregg, Lorraine Ashbourne's in it. And it's about a group of women who've basically had a belly full and form a punk band. Is it any good?
I enjoyed this. I think just seeing the concept of it, of, you know, joining a punk rock band, immediately would make me sceptical. Just because you're sort of thinking, well, how can you sort of have the music industry tapped into a TV show? It isn't always easy. What if it ends up falling into loads of cliches? But I think from the start, the fact that it contains the words Sally Wainwright, who of course is the person behind Happy Valley, one of my favourite shows of the last 10 years, alongside other great shows such as Last Tango in Halifax and Gentleman Jack, you know, made me feel a lot more comfortable. I think it's the fact that not only have you got a great cast, I think it's also sort of tapping into what it is like to be in your 50s and 60s and at a real crossroads. I mean, you're sort of, you may be feeling like you are sort of feeling a little bit forgotten, a little bit ignored. There's a scene where Beth, played by Joanne Froggatt in the opening episode has a door sort of shut on her face because the pupils at the school she works at don't even see her. And also you're at this crossroads where if you have kids, your kids may have flown the nest. If you've got parents still, you know, you're dealing with potentially their health issues and all of the challenges, of course, that comes with the menopause. And I think Sally's been able to reflect that whilst also, and I think most importantly, not making it catered to the purely to those audiences. She never forgets of having interesting stories, good characters and a good storyline. So I've seen the first half. I think if it takes a little while to get into, but I think by sort of episode two, it really finds its footing. And the other thing I love about Sally is that she knows how to balance, I think, good sort of storytelling, but also making sure that it's full of humour. She did an interview in the Sunday Times quite recently where she talks about that even in life's darkest moments, you know, there is a purpose of having humour. You know, you can find humour in anything dark. And I think that is something like, it starts with this series, and I won't be any spoilers here, but it starts with one of the darkest scenes imaginable in episode one of Riot Women, followed by a really, like, really dark bit of humour that just works because it's Sally.
Well, I do know that people have absolutely loved this. And Josh says, I've devoured it and I need another series. Well, Josh, I'm pretty sure you're going to get one, let's be honest. And I really want you to get a moment or two to talk about Boots. Now, this is on Netflix. And this is a really, really interesting subject for a drama, Scott. Tell us more.
So it's about, it's based off a sort of memoir, and it's about a boy who enters the Marines. And this was in the era of, you know, where you wouldn't be able to reveal your sexuality or be booted out. So essentially he's realizing his sexuality at the time of being in the US military. So as you can imagine, there's a lot of a lot of yelling, a lot of homophobia. He's sort of working out his true self whilst also dealing in this incredibly macho, masculine environment. And I think it sort of taps into what it was like to serve in the military and not disclose your sexuality for the complexities of doing so. I think a challenge with it is that for some reason, midway through, it steps away from the most interesting and complex parts and tries to make it a bit more of a fun comedy drama. But I think it taps into sort of those themes quite well. And it just makes me realise how much has changed in our society in such a short space of time. Like, you know, you of course, you know, the British Army has of course, changed their policies fundamentally. But also, you know, rightly, you know, the people who have some people who have experienced horrible experiences whilst being in our military services are now receiving sort of some apology, you know, not always the case, but you know, we are making strides.
Yeah, although Pete Hegseth might have a view on some of that, unfortunately. Thank you very much indeed, Scott. Always good
thank
to
you.
Talk to you. Scott Bryan with some of his recommendations. Riot Women, Boots on Netflix, and of course Celebrity Traitors back on the telly tonight at 9 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Mostly, Matthew, I hope you managed re-entry at the right time in that conversation. Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock, you're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. In the next hour of this programme, Israel has halved the amount of aid getting into Gaza after the bodies of dead hostages were not returned by yesterday's deadline. We'll hear from voices in both Israel and Gaza. Will the proposed digital ID scheme actually prevent illegal working in the UK? We will ask Chris Stokel-Walker, and our big interview today is All the Tudors and Then Some, historical novelist Philippa Gregory on her latest book, The Other Berlin Girl. Let's get the latest news with Tom Noonan.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Dominic Cummings has claimed China has compromised the system used to transfer highly secret data around Whitehall. Boris Johnson's former senior adviser has exclusively told The Times Beijing has obtained vast amounts of classified government information over many years. Mr. Cummings says he and Boris Johnson found this out in 2020. The government has been approached for comment. The government is already under pressure about how it describes the threat posed by China. This afternoon, the Prime Minister has confirmed the government will publish in full the evidence it submitted for spying prosecutions against two men. Sir Keir Starmer was challenged at Prime Minister's questions by the Conservative MP Tom Tugendhat, who says ministers are responsible for the collapse of that case.
Although he has answered the question about evidence, the real question is, what political direction did this government give to their officials before they went to give evidence?
Absolutely none. Absolutely none.
Israel says it will not compromise on the return of dead hostages from Gaza after saying Hamas has returned a body which is not one of those Israeli captives. The Israeli government says the terror group should have released all 28 bodies on Monday, but 21 are still in Gaza. Hamas says it needs more time. Gershon Baskin is a former Israeli hostage negotiator, and he told Times Radio he doesn't think the terror group is deliberately trying to scupper the deal.
I believe that the Hamas side wants very much for this war not to be renewed. A lot of the emphasis in the negotiations that I was part of, at least, was about the guarantees that Israel would not renew the war once the living hostages are released. I know that the Israeli army does not want to renew this war. They thought it should have ended a long time ago. The Israeli government is a different case.
In response to the delays, Israel has cut some aid deliveries to Gaza. The government is introducing a range of new sanctions to target Russian oil. The Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper updated MPs this afternoon.
With immediate effect, we are sanctioning Russia's two largest oil producers, Rosneft and Lukoil, the two biggest Russian energy firms ever targeted by UK sanctions. Part of an extensive new sanctions package of 90 targets, including refineries around the world that are responsible for importing Russian oil.
The sanctions also affect companies which help Russian oil access the global market, including firms registered in China, India and the UAE. Angela Rayner has accepted a severance payment of nearly £17,000 despite voting against such payments for ministers who resign. New rules, which the former Deputy Prime Minister voted for, will ban ministers from claiming an exit payment if they commit a serious breach of the ministerial code. Her spokesperson says underpaying stamp duty was not considered to be a serious breach. The company linked to the former Conservative peer Michelle Moan has until 4 to repay £122 million. PPE MedPro was ordered by the High Court to compensate the government for breaching its COVID contracts by delivering gowns that weren't sterile. The company denies that was the case. And driverless taxis will start operating in London next year. It'll be the first European city to welcome the cars made by Google-owned company Waymo. For news when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
I tell you what, people really do love Riot Women. Betty says it's amazing. It's got humour, it's got the dark side of life. Great writing talent from Sally, weaving and bringing characters leaping off the screen. It grabs you, holds your attention, lots of laughs, heartfelt emotions. It's a cracker. I hope there'll be another series. I honestly think Betty liked it. Keep your thoughts coming on 0333 003 2353 and we'll have some more telly picks from Scott Bryan at around the same time next week. Our big guest after 3.30 today is the author Philippa Gregory. She's talking about her new book. It's already a bestseller. It is called Berlin Traitor and it's about a lesser known Berlin, Jane, who was the sister-in-law of Anne and had an absolutely fascinating life. That is after 3:30 this afternoon. Now, Israel says one of the bodies returned by Hamas is actually not that of a hostage. Aid supplies into Gaza have been halved by Israel after the bodies of other kidnapped Israelis were not returned by the agreed deadline. In a moment, we'll talk to Aria Kovler, who is an analyst in Israel. But first, let's go to Gaza and try to have a word with Caroline Willeman, who is a Médecins Sans Frontières project coordinator in Al-Mawasi in the Strip. Caroline, I hope you can hear me OK. Can you just give us an impression of daily life where you are right now?
Yeah, sure. Good afternoon. I'm actually in Deir al-Balah at the moment.
where, of course, we are very relieved that the ceasefire for now seems to take hold. So we do see a lot less wounded people coming into our emergency rooms. It's not zero. We do still receive people with gunshot wounds who have approached the so-called yellow line too closely, who have been shot at by the Israeli forces, keeping in mind that many people don't really know where this line is. So this is also a result of confusion. But it's also true that other than the bombing, the humanitarian situation remains the same.
Okay. To interrupt you, Caroline, but you've had people coming in today who have been shot by the IDF.
We've had them the last few days. I do not have the latest figures of today, but I know that they have been, my own colleagues have seen these cases with their own eyes after the ceasefire.
Yes, and we also do need to be clear about this. People have also been hurt by some of the Hamas patrols that are still going around. Is that the case?
So this is also what we have heard in the news, that indeed also there have been clashes between Hamas and certain families. As far as I'm aware, we have not received these patients ourselves. So this is for us news we are repeating rather than speaking of our own patients.
Okay, well, I appreciate your honesty in admitting that you don't know the full story, but you are hearing exactly that. So thank you for being so clear. Can you just tell us, Caroline, if you were, for example, a mother, I don't know, in her late 20s, perhaps with two or three children, would you be safe today to go out to try to buy some food in Gaza?
You might be safe. Whether you can afford the food is a whole other question. We continue to diagnose children with both moderate and severe acute malnutrition on a daily basis. So while more food has come in, I was here in summer when clearly the situation was more desperate, but still it's not reaching everyone. And so again, depending on where you are going, you might not be 100% safe. Again, there is people getting close to the yellow line because they don't know exactly where it is. And there is indeed also a breakdown in social fabric that can bring along with it a chaos that didn't necessarily exist before.
So actually, you're saying that a woman on her own might actually be extremely vulnerable?
She might very well be indeed. And I mean, I would argue that the vast majority of people here in Gaza have been made to become vulnerable because of what they have lived in the last 2 years and the conditions that they do still live in at this very moment. So many people are still in tents as well. We still have sun, but it's getting colder. Winter is coming. There are a myriad different ways in which people will need to be protected in the weeks and months to come.
You mentioned food prices. Food, I understand, has gone up by as much as 30%. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed. So it has come down somewhat from when I was here in July, August, when it was really at the peak and prices were indescribable. A kilo of sugar would go for $120. But food items are still expensive, and many people have not had an income for 2 years. And this is exactly why we continue to see cases of both moderate and severe malnutrition in the children that we screen in our primary healthcare centres.
But some sort of makeshift marketplaces have been appearing.
Yes, we do see some food in the market and more than when I was here in summer. Like, obviously, there's so much destruction. You can't say you see shops, but there are small stalls where we do see food for sale. And in terms of the malnutrition, the issue is more, can people afford to buy something?
And you obviously, as you've indicated, it isn't cold at the moment. I did have a look at the temperature earlier, and for what it's worth, I think a reputable site was saying that it was about 27 Celsius today. So it is not cold during the day, but that will change quite soon. And we've seen these devastating images of people going back to just a wasteland of rubble and nothingness. Where are those people spending the night?
So many, many people are in tents, and we even see people here, even around us, who don't even have access to a tent. So some people are under clear skies. And indeed, as you say, daytime still nice and warm. At nighttime, we start to feel that that there starts to be a chill in the air. It will take time before it gets actually cold, but it's certainly already a temperature where I consider myself very lucky that I'm not sleeping in a tent, because nighttimes are already getting colder. And again, this is just the very, very beginning.
I'm assuming, Caroline, that you at least have a functioning sewage system. Is there a water supply? What about electricity?
So we do. Of course, the vast majority of people here, they don't. They stand in line with their jerry cans to get drinking water. Many people don't have access to proper toilets, to soap, and electricity is an issue as well. So some people might have solar, like a small solar power bank, but many people don't. Like, vast majority of my colleagues will come into work and plug in their devices because they don't have the option to do that in whatever tent or elsewhere where they live.
Now, when the conference happened in Egypt earlier in the week, there was real optimism and a mood of celebration. Yesterday, I think spirits were somewhat muted. There was cause to believe that actually this could all go very badly wrong very quickly. How would you assess the current mood from your perspective as someone who's working for MSF?
So I have actually seen from day one, I found the reaction of my Palestinian colleagues actually quite muted. They have hope, but it's a very, very fragile hope. They have suffered a horror for 2 years straight, and they know what happened the last ceasefire. It lasted only 2 months. So yes, people want to be hopeful. People want to go back. And I've watched, I'm right on this coastal road where I've watched hundreds of thousands of people go north, and they're happy about that. But indeed, they also know they go back to nothing. So there is hope, but I would really call it a very fragile hope. People are happy their children sleep at night right now, but they are afraid that it might not last.
We've just heard, actually, Caroline, that the Rafah crossing is going to open again tomorrow. Will that make a difference?
Hopefully, I mean, in terms of supplies, for example, for us, we continue to face issues with what the Israeli authorities call the dual use items. There is a vast, vast range of items that are considered that they could be not just for medical use, but we are talking about vital equipment that we need for water purification, but also for the sterilization equipment in our hospitals, that still we continue not to be allowed to enter. And this will be vital as medical needs remain very, very high, even if we get less newly wounded coming in. And indeed, that Rafah crossing, also for other aid, whether it's food, shelter, hygiene kits, is vital. We need all border crossings open and aid to flow in under the coordination of the United Nations.
Very grateful to you for your time. Thank you, Caroline. Caroline Willeman, who works for Médecins Sans Frontières as a project coordinator in the Gaza Strip. Let's go to Israel and analyst Aryeh Kovler. Aryeh, we know that the aid supplies into Gaza were halved by the Israeli authorities after the bodies of kidnapped Israelis were not returned by the agreed deadline. Why did that happen, do you think? I mean, not the halving of the aid, but the confusion about the body.
It's not completely clear to me the aid has been cut in half. I've been trying to get confirmed reports of this. Because this morning, Israel kind of said the sanctions that it had discussed were not going to be implemented. And we see with the opening of Rafah's plan tomorrow that this does seem to be the case. There were a couple of different things that happened. First thing that happened was that on the day of the final of the hostages being handed over, that evening, when Hamas was supposed to return a number of bodies of hostages, they returned only four. Israel at that point said, "You're not being serious. We know you have more than that. We know you have more than that relatively easily on hand. We're talking about imposing these kind of, they call them sanctions, essentially. They're not calling off the deal, but, like, you know, something that is in addition to sanctions." Hamas said, "Oh, actually, we found four more, and we've found another four coming soon." So then last night they kind of rushed, gave four bodies back again. And in the course of the investigations, it has transpired that one of them is not the body of one of the Israeli hostages. We don't know who it is. It's probably a Palestinian from Gaza. Makes sense. Israel is not, in response to this, throwing its toys out the pram. There does seem to be some understanding on the Israeli side. It's not being said explicitly, but it's from what's not being said, that this may have been a genuine mistake. You know, Hamas has these bodies where they have them and is trying to get the right ones and is, you know, not always succeeding.
It's actually very unpleasant to talk about this in any detail, isn't it? But we have to just acknowledge the fact that these bodies have been lying who knows where in all sorts of horrific conditions for who knows how long. So you can understand that this is going to be quite a difficult business. Benjamin...
Yeah. And while the soldiers have dog tags, a number of the bodies are not soldiers. They're, you know, regular civilians and have no easy ID.
Yeah, it's all very, very grim. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu back in court for his corruption trial. We heard Donald Trump earlier in the week calling for a pardon. Can you just remind us what exactly he's accused of doing?
So he's on trial for three different corruption affairs, one of which involves receiving large, very expensive gifts, champagne and cigars worth tens of thousands, in return for helping out the donors with some legal issues and passing some favourable laws for them. And a couple of them relating to essentially giving an easy time for media mergers in return for favourable coverage from media outlets, which is being kind of considered bribery in Israel. These are not straightforward charges. It's reasonably clear what he did. It's not 100% clear that it's illegal. And the case has been going on now for many years with no resolution in sight.
Well, when Donald Trump suggested that, well, I think he turned to President Herzog, didn't he, and said, come on, pardon him. Was there some sort of method in that? Would it be possible for the president to pardon him? I don't know how the Israeli constitution works.
The president has pardon power. I'm not sure if he can do it until you're convicted, actually. Might have to wait until afterwards. The president can pardon people. Accepting a pardon would be seen as, you know, perhaps accepting guilt. The issue here is that Netanyahu's cases, on the one hand, they keep him in court. He says to come out and stop being prime minister and sit in the court for a long time. Mm. And although he always finds a way of getting out of it. Today, he said he had a cough and had to leave. The other thing that's happening right now is that the Likud party is considering passing some kind of law that would essentially get him off the hook. Some kind of retroactive, he's done the wrong law, basking in kind of the glory of the recent deal. If that happens, I think it will be incredibly controversial. It's not clear to me they'll have the votes to pass it, but it is being pushed right now by the Justice Minister.
Thank you very much indeed for your time. That's the analyst Aryeh Kovlev talking to us from Israel. Before that, you heard from MSF project coordinator Caroline Willman in Gaza.
Coming up, OpenAI is planning to relax some of its restrictions for ChatGPT users. We'll find out more from our resident tech journalist, Chris Stokel-Walker. It's 18 minutes past three. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Global events.
The war has triggered an energy crisis, of course, all across Europe.
Reactive analysis.
Well, let's turn now to the MP behind that amendment.
Breaking news.
We're keeping an eye on the Middle East as ever, where Israel continues to face pressure from all sides.
There's this question about where the money will come from.
From the world's best journalists.
Time now to invite you to our briefing room and talk to one of our leading strategic experts.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working, offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
Ever wondered what power is? Power is transforming the sun into your own energy source. Power is getting energy companies to pay you. Power is enjoying your morning coffee, knowing you created the energy to make it. Well, you and the colossal ball of fire in the sky. Because with solar panels from Hive, the sun works for you. Hive, know your power. May not cover all electricity usage, roof and weather dependent. Paid for surplus requires eligible SET tariff.
Here's to the moment. To the places that give you perspective and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silversea brings you closer to the rare, the remote and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Everything's computer.
There he is. OpenAI will widen its available content to include erotica for adults on ChatGPT. Sam Altman took to X, such a journalistic phrase, he took to X to announce the plan. He said it will allow the chatbot to behave in a more human-like way. Well, let's talk to Chris Stokel-Walker about this. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Fee.
So Sam Altman says that he wants to treat adult users like adults. And the huge problem here, Chris, is when they aren't adults. And it does seem like maybe the same path to a little bit of danger is being trodden that we've gone down before. What do you think?
I agree with you wholeheartedly there. We have seen OpenAI come out of the woods with the really rough time that it had over allegations around encouraging children, young people to take their lives or to self-harm as a result of interacting with the chatbots. It correctly took corrective measures to try and solve that, really tamped down on what the chatbot was able to do. They now believe that they have got to grips with that. I mean, whether or not that is true, I think will depend on your ability to prod and probe at some of the weaknesses of these AI models. But they now think that that gives them a little bit of breathing space in order to actually let go of some of those restrictions somewhat. So, yes, good news if you are really keen on this, although I imagine that actually the constituency that is incredibly small and probably will find another way of interacting with a chatbot if they wanted to in this way. My concern, like yours, Fee, is that this is predicated on OpenAI estimating the age of its users. So it believes that it can get to pretty close understandings of how old they are and then allow either a kind of throttling or not of what you're allowed to do on your chatbot. Not entirely certain that will be fully accurate.
So one of the huge problems has been, as you alluded to, us as humans not being able to really distinguish between a human reaction to a problem and an AI-generated reaction to a problem. And as you also mentioned, there have been very clear examples of where young people, completely understandably, have really mixed those two things. So, of course, it's going to be dangerous. If you're a young teenager, you've never had a relationship before, but you find that this tiny thing, this app on your phone, can start to make you feel loved. It can start to make you feel excited. It can give you a human reaction, even though it's not. So I think we just always need to spell out exactly what's going on here, don't we? Because sometimes it's our illiteracy in this area that seems to allow very dangerous things to creep in. Would you agree?
I would. I think that it's not necessarily just our illiteracy as users, Fee. We do have to bear in mind that we aren't always to blame here. Actually, there are two sides to this whole interaction. And the AI companies themselves, by design, are making these chatbots incredibly human-like, incredibly convincing, and incredibly engaging. So if you find either yourself or you find a younger relative who is using these chatbots and is getting convinced that actually they have built up a connection in some way with it, that is not necessarily their fault. They are not being gullible here. These tools are designed to mimic human interaction, to encourage us to continue interacting with them and to almost validate our opinions. And we obviously saw that in recent months with OpenAI's ChatGPT becoming too sycophantic and then them starting to roll that back a little bit. We talked about that several months ago. Don't be sort of feeling bad if you are the person who is hoodwinked or if you have a relative who is. It is not necessarily your fault, although we do need to always try and take a step back and recognise that this is by design, that this is happening.
Yeah, and we just need to talk about it an awful lot more, don't we? Let's talk about politics as well. Keir Starmer has misrepresented his digital ID scheme, which won't actually stop illegal working, according to a lobby group called Tech UK. Who are Tech UK?
They are basically one of the strongest, biggest groups within the tech sector in the UK, represent an awful lot of big businesses and small alike. And generally, when they say something, you have to sit up and notice. So the fact that they are saying that you're presenting digital ideas, this silver bullet. I was listening this morning to Stig and Kate talking about things that we should not talk about, cliches like this. So a silver bullet was on that list of forbidden words. But anyway, we'll use it as a kind of way of solving legal working. Oversimplifies these really complex issues around immigration. I think that is one that has been held as a viewpoint amongst many people who think that actually the digital ID approach by the government here is maybe a little bit misguided.
Who's doing it better? Can we learn from somebody else who's already put this into practice?
We can. You spoke to Mark Selman a couple of weeks ago, very kindly stepped in large part because I was in Estonia at the time. And Estonia is the leading light in terms of digital identification in Europe. They make a huge deal of the fact that they are able to do this and are leading the way. Now, you know, Estonia is a very different country to the UK with the best will in the world. It is incredibly small in comparison. Much newer, sort of post-Soviet in the 1990s, was set up and got its independence. And they are also very tech-forward. So they have huge companies, the likes of Skype, the likes of Bolt, which many of us might have used as a kind of Uber alternative when we are on the continent. They are generally set up for this sort of thing in a way that we aren't necessarily. And they're sort of... Their constituents, their population are much more willing to adopt technology than perhaps we are. We are old cynics here in the UK, and often that's no bad thing.
Yep. Tell us a little bit about what might be about to happen to Google in the UK.
Yeah, it could see its wings clipped, I think, by the Competition and Markets Authority, the antitrust regulator here in the UK, has said that Google has so-called strategic market status. Now, in reality, what that means is the CMA is basically tapping Google on the shoulder and saying, well, we're going to keep a little eye on you because actually we think that you have maybe a little bit too much power in the search engine market. We reserve the right at a future date to maybe step in and say you need to change your ways. Really, I don't think that's going to happen because Google is now on watch, although they are very unhappy with being deemed as a strategic market dominant force. And they're actually saying that this means that they might have to step back some of their innovation, particularly in the UK, much to the detriment of our everyday users.
OK. Chris, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. And by the way, your pot plant is looking magnificent. Even though you've been away in Estonia, you've clearly been watering it in exactly the right kind of way. Well done, you.
Thank you. Hail and hearty.
Yes, it's quite all right.
The same pot plant, because it's had troubled times in the past.
It's had very troubled times. Had a near-death experience about 6 months ago. We had
revived.
To intervene, didn't we? Yeah. As the centrist grannies who care about everything.
Well, not everything. Right. We are going to be at the Cheltenham Literature Festival.
Oh, my word, we are.
Whether Cheltenham likes it or not, we're going to be there tomorrow. We're doing the radio programme from some sort of roped off area, a special zone which has been put aside for our exclusive use, and then we are moving into a more theatrical environment at 3:30 to talk about just about everything really with Penny Lancaster, loose woman, special constable, former model and wife of a crooner,
Rod Stewart.
Yeah.
She does give away some delicious details about life with Rod Stewart, who I think we can say has entered an era of eccentricity. We will be asking her about that.
Yes, indeed. If you're able to come along, we'd love to see you tomorrow in Cheltenham at the Literature Festival. But if you can't be bothered, you can hear some of it here on Times Radio from 3:30. Well, indeed, from never mind. We'll be on at 2:00.
The junctions are going to be a little bit difficult. Bear with us. We might creak tomorrow afternoon.
There's every chance of that. Our big guest coming up after the headlines is the brilliant historical novelist Philippa Gregory. Let's get the latest news headlines at 3:30 on Times Radio. Here's Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. A former funeral director in Hull has pleaded guilty to 35 counts of fraud by false representation after a major investigation into human remains found at his business. 47-year-old Robert Bush has also admitted one charge of fraudulent trading in relation to funeral plans. However, he denies 30 counts of preventing the lawful and decent burial of a body and one charge of theft from charities. Dominic Cummings has told The Times China has compromised the government's system for transferring classified information around Whitehall. Mr. Cummings says this was revealed when he was Boris Johnson's senior adviser in 2020. He claims Beijing has obtained vast amounts of classified information, including the most secret kind, over many years. The government is already under pressure on the threat of China. Sir Keir Starmer says the government will publish in full the evidence it submitted to the spying case against two men before it collapsed. Oliver Wright is the Times' policy editor.
It's a real problem to the government. They are facing these increasing claims that ministers had some kind of involvement in this, that they wanted to preserve their relationship with China, and as a consequence of which, they were very happy for this case to drop. Now, they deny that, but I think, you know, over the coming days, we'll find out a much more accurate picture of exactly who knew what in government and when.
Israel says it will not compromise on the return of dead hostages. It says Hamas handed over a body last night which was not that of a hostage. The terror group says it needs more time to return the remaining 21. And Rachel Reeves is again considering cutting the cash ISA allowance for savers in her budget next month. The Chancellor wants to get people investing more of their money, but shelves plans to cut the £20,000 limit in July after a backlash from banks and building societies. Don't forget, you can set the Times News briefing as your new service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
My dad was a fantastic builder. Plumbing, electrics, carpentry, there was nothing he couldn't do. But he's 83 now and he can't do any of that stuff anymore. That's hard when you've always been so capable. Unfortunately, Mum died a couple of years ago now, so he does feel quite isolated. Huh. At least he did until Kerry arrived. She's been amazing. She's Dad's care professional from Home Instead. They provide the best quality care in your own home. Dad'll never want to leave that cottage. Well, he restored it practically from scratch, all on his own. We all pop over to see him whenever we can, but we've all got busy lives. So it's real peace of mind that Kerry can be there when we're not. She helps him with all the things he can't do for himself anymore. But we've told her the only things she's allowed to do relating to building is make Dad's favourite builder's brew.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Ever wondered what power is? Power is transforming the sun into your own energy source. Power is getting energy companies to pay you. Power is enjoying your morning coffee, knowing you created the energy to make it. Well, you and the colossal ball of fire in the sky. Because with solar panels from Hive, the sun works for you. Hive, know your power. May not cover all electricity usage, roof and weather dependent. Paid for surplus requires eligible SET tariff.
Daryl Morris wraps up the weekend's news and takes a look at the week ahead. Saturday and Sunday from 10 p.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wix, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
Good afternoon. 26 minutes to 4 o'clock. Now, Philippa Gregory is one of Britain's most successful and best-loved historical novelists. You will almost certainly know her work, The Other Boleyn Girl. And in her latest novel, Boleyn Traitor, Philippa has returned to the drama and the intrigue of the court of Henry VIII. But this time, her focus is on another woman, another Boleyn, Anne Boleyn's sister-in-law, Jane. Philippa told me about Jane Boleyn, who arrived at the Tudor court as a very young girl.
Well, she's a professional courtier, so she does come at 12 to the court of Catherine of Aragon to be a maid-in-waiting. And she's married to the son of an up-and-coming family whose lands are near hers. She's the daughter of Lord Morley, so she's no nobility, but not one of the big houses. And the young man who's picked for her, about her age, very suitable marriage, is George Boleyn, who is, you know, with a bit of luck, going to become a minor diplomat. But the luck changes rather when his sister marries the King of England. So all of a sudden, Jane finds herself not the wife of a junior diplomat, but of the most important man in England after the King. Favourite of the King, favourite of Anne, memorably. And Jane herself gets promoted, Jane Boleyn gets promoted to be chief lady-in-waiting of the Queen's rooms.
You only have to read 50 or 60 pages of this book to be plunged into a world that, honestly, from our perspective, it, Philippa, it sounds horrible. It really. I mean, we sort of love the costumes and we like all hearing about all the rivalries, but it's so tough just to keep going. And Jane Boleyn doesn't meet the happiest of ends, which we can discuss a bit later. But it's more than intrigue. It's vicious and vile, and you live on your wits, knowing that actually you could end up dead.
Yes. I mean, it's a court of a tyrant. And so when I was researching for it, I didn't just read up about Renaissance masks and dancing. So all of the costumes and the colour and the vibrancy and the art of the court is there. But I also read up about what it was like working with Hitler and with Stalin, and the idea that actually tyrants seem to be very similar. They are quite tediously similar. So the court always ends up focusing on them as an individual. It ends up moving very fast from policy to whim.
Yeah.
And then what tyrants always seem to do is they activate the law of the land that they come to and turn it into, in a sense, their own personal grudge-setting agenda.
So, I mean, how much were you thinking about Donald Trump as well?
Of course I was thinking about Donald Trump as well. And what was so interesting is to be writing this novel at this time where people are increasingly saying America is drifting into a tyranny, and seeing that this is the time where England experiences its first tyranny, that before Henry VIII, English kings were called Your Grace, like dukes were called Your Grace, and they were first among equals. And that's the real sense of the word, that he's the king, but he's one of the nobility. And Henry VIII changes that title to Your Majesty, and we still have that today.
Yes. Well, I hope I won't live long enough, because I won't be 350 years of age. Do you think it would be possible that one day a historical novelist will write about the Windsors and see some parallels with a Tudor court?
Well, the reason I'm never bothered with the Windsors in terms of research and writing, is because what interests me is the coalition of personal and political, and the coincidence of royalty and tyranny. So that's why Henry's so interesting, that he's a king who claims the status of a demigod.
Yeah.
And that's what makes him interesting, whereas our current king is clearly a democrat, and that's a really refreshing thing to have in a royal family. You absolutely need it, but where you see the danger now lies is people who are elected claiming the status of kingship.
Yeah. Let's talk more about the character of Henry VIII, who is taught in schools. Every school child in the land will hear about Henry VIII. And there's a sort of, I mean, depending on the age of the child, there's a sort of temptation to dismiss him as a funny old chap with red hair and did a bit of jousting and had six wives and ho, ho, ho. But as you've already said, he was a tyrannical despot of a man. He was also impotent, ulcerated legs, profoundly overweight, and just revolting. And he was a serial killer.
I think the really important thing about the six wives motif is that it's only now that we are saying he has six wives, because he either puts them aside, exiles them, or they die in childbirth, or he executes them. He changes the law of the land so that he can execute his wives that he has chosen, first of all, as his wives, and he has chosen the advisers who create the evidence against them. It's, you know, it's literally, it's a story of a serial killer.
And we need to, do you think we've been a bit squeamish about this, and perhaps, maybe it's feminism's duty, yet another one, to actually acknowledge that this much-discussed monarch was exactly that?
I think it's more patriarchy's duty to acknowledge it rather than ours, yeah, since we're the ones who suffer from it. But it's part of a bigger thing, I think, which is that a degree of tyranny is acceptable in men, particularly in this period, noblemen or kings,
yeah,
in our period, men of influence or power or wealth get away with an enormous amount of tyranny politically and also get away with it personally. And, you know, we see in the statistics of the number of women who are abused, the number of women who are raped, the proportion that it is their husbands and their partners. What we do constantly in history as historians, as in our current social life, is we don't challenge it. We let men get away with it.
Well, and in the past, of course, male writers, male historians, talked about women from history and would dismiss them as sluts and harlots. That was quite routine.
Well, yes, and the very description of Catherine Howard, who is executed for adultery because Henry changes the law in order to make her pre-contract illegal. He literally changes the law in order to execute her. And she, even in a history book written in this century, is described as a slut. And you just go like, this is no adequate description of a woman. Apart from anything else, nobody is a one word. You know, if you're a historian, you have an obligation, I think, to try and give a rounded picture of a person. And, you know, in the case of the Queens, they are all dismissed with one-word stereotypes.
Let's go back to Jane Boleyn then. Yeah. She should logically have fallen with her in-laws when Anne Boleyn was executed because she was related to her, she'd been very close to her. She wasn't. Why wasn't she?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, and in a sense, again, historians have been quite remiss in not asking that question. So what people just go is like, I don't quite know how, but next queen, she's lady-in-waiting. Queen after that, Anne of Cleves, she's lady-in-waiting again. Queen after that, Catherine Howard, she's lady-in-waiting again. How does this woman pull it off when her sister-in-law and her husband were executed for treason? And a widow to a traitor, would normally have all of her fortune taken from her.
And that just didn't happen.
There's an Act of Parliament passed to give her Blickling Hall in Norfolk, now still an enormous, beautiful, stately home, and a fortune for life. And you have to say, who has the power to get that law through Parliament? And there's nobody that I can think of at that time except Thomas Cromwell. And I think it's Thomas Cromwell.
Okay, you just better remind everybody of the significance of the name Thomas Cromwell. Who was he?
Well, everyone who's read Hilary Mantel's wonderful novel Wolf Hall loves Thomas Cromwell. He was a much more ambivalent character at the time. He was Henry's great advisor. He was very instrumental in Henry's move towards tyranny. He was very helpful in changing the law to suit Henry so that he could move towards tyranny. And in the end, he was executed by the change in the law that he had brought about. So Henry could sign off on his execution. He didn't have to have a fair trial. So he's punished, in a sense, by his very own misdeeds. At the time, he runs the country. Mm. So he's responsible for the Reformation, for the inquiry into the monasteries. He's responsible for managing Parliament. He manages the king's temperament and moods personally. He's Mr. Fix-It for Henry. He does everything. And I think what he does this by a network of spies and administrators and people reporting to him. We know he has that throughout Europe, from his commercial days as a wool trader. And he does it throughout England by appointing sheriffs and mayors who report back to him the mood of the country. And I'm sure he does it in the courts as well by having noblemen in his pay that report to him and noble women as well.
Because noble women, of course, were in places where noble men on the whole couldn't go.
He has to have spies in the Queen's chamber. And as a man who doesn't have a wife or daughters in that position, he's literally got to hire them. And you can see, I mean, literally, we've got the signatures of three of them on the document which explains why Anne of Cleves' marriage can be annulled. So it's Cromwell's job to get Anne out of the king's bed, out of the marriage, out of the queenhood, to make space for Catherine Howard, who's going to come next. And he gets this extraordinary document of evidence that the king has never slept with her, that she doesn't know what's supposed to happen in bed, and that she is a virgin as she came to England. And that's signed, this document, which is clearly invented, is signed off by three women of the Her Lady's Court, and one of them is Jane Rochford.
Jane Boleyn. Yeah, and she knew what she was doing by signing that quite clearly.
She was actually saving the Queen's life, because if Henry hadn't got rid of her that way, he would have almost certainly have found another way to get rid of her.
And the stuff of myth around Anne of Cleves is that she was too ugly. And, I mean, that's what little I know of her.
That's the one-word stereotype. What do you have
We're
about
back to
the
that.
Queens?
Yeah.
Catherine of Aragon, old. Anne Boleyn, sexy, Protestant. Jane Seymour, good wife, but dead.
It's hard to be a good wife when you're dead.
As good wives, you know, traditionally are. Anne of Cleves, fat, ugly. And that's literally Henry's complaint about her in order to get the divorce through to explain why he was impotent with her.
Yes, I mean, it really does make you profoundly grateful. I'm going to say that things have moved on. And what really makes you despair in this book, you do these very visceral descriptions of stillbirth and miscarriage, because that was the stuff of life for women of childbearing age, wasn't it? I mean, it was properly brutal.
I think the death rate of women in childbirth is comparable to the death rate of men in battle. It is women's battleground. It is women's war against death in childbed without any competent science of gynaecology or obstetrics and no anaesthesia at all. So literally you're doing it cold turkey or you're doing it drunk as a skunk. There's nothing between.
Sorry, take a little bit of a chew to break it while we think about that.
Yes. And also remember, no contraception, so there's no choice.
No, but so all that bloody, messy, violent business plays out in the same environment where we have these masks and this idea of courtly love, so superficial, such tosh, and often resulting in a woman dying in childbirth.
Oh, yeah, but you're being very modern.
Am I? Oh, sorry.
You're being very, very
modern. I've not been accused of that all that often. Not lately.
Well, the mask and the glamour and the guilt on the coffin, this is exactly how the medieval world bears itself.
Right.
It's how it makes it tolerable that you could be Queen of England with a cloak of ermine and the king's ransom on your head and fingers. You could wear diamonds in your hair. You have diamond buttons. You have pearl, you know, stitched in your clothes. Your gown is so heavy with jewels that you can barely stand up. You have to have people either side of you helping you to walk. And the price you pay for that is that you are quite likely to die in childbirth, and you will certainly have a horrendous time both trying to conceive and trying to give birth to any child that Henry might have. That's the deal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a deal that women make these days when they go into marriages in which the profits are very, very clear and the disadvantages are very, very clear as well.
Right. Effectively, the women that feature in this book, they were... Would it be fair to say they were pimped out by their families, basically, to marry Henry?
Well, they know and the families know and everybody knows that they are a commodity. You know, women are owned by their fathers by law. So if you're a poor working woman, you could literally be harnessed to the plough if the ox was ill that day. And that's fair enough. That's part of the culture of life. So if you're a noble woman, your job is to further your family's fortunes and destiny, and you know that's your job. Just as if you were a boy like George Boleyn, you would have to go into the diplomatic corps, you'd have to go abroad. If there was a war, you'd have to fight in the war. If you have to be good at jousting, which is really, really dangerous.
Well,
but it's just part of the how to be a noble Tudor.
You say in this book that it was Henry's jousting accident. I wrote down the date of it.
1536.
There we are. I'm never that good with dates, which is why I had to write it down. You say it had a quite profound effect on him, that he was never the same afterwards. Now, sometimes people say, well, Philippa Gregory writes a cracking yarn, but I'd take issue with some of her facts. What is the truth about that accident?
That's not my supposition. There's actually a book by the historian Susanna Lipscomb called 1536, which says this is the benchmark in Henry's career. It's after the fall that he turns against Anne. The fall causes Anne's miscarriage, and his health certainly deteriorates dramatically.
She miscarries because of the stress of his fall?
We don't know. I mean, she miscarries. Okay. She blames it on the stress of his fall because
right.
that way she can sign it off to wifely devotion.
Ah, okay.
So it's more window dressing than medical fact. Of course, it's not medical fact.
Right. But I know you always, at the end of the book, you include a list of sources and of recommended reading. You take the whole business of the history very, very seriously indeed. And I know there is a book about Jane Boleyn that you used to research this novel?
Very much so. There's a very, very good biography by Julia Fox, which I depended on for the bones of Jane's story. So all of the facts, which always served to me as a sort of bus stop that I drive along. So all of the facts that are known are in the novel. But what the novel brings to it is the things that cannot be known. So lots and lots of private life, lots and lots of gaps when she simply drops from the historical record. We don't know what she's doing. The things that are absolutely secret and that I speculate she's doing. And in the novel, because I'm writing a novel, I write it as fiction, but I wouldn't stand behind it as a historian without saying, I think it's very likely that she's working for Thomas Cromwell for the reasons we described.
Yeah,
because but there's no evidence for that because it's spy work, it's secret work. Mm. There should be no evidence for it.
Otherwise she'd be useless at it.
Otherwise he would be useless at it, and he clearly wasn't that.
No, he certainly wasn't that. Her life ends not that far from where we're sitting right now. And I've said this before, but the Tower of London, I don't know how people can visit it. I've been on a few school trips and other visits. It's just a terrifying place. Maybe I've read too many of your books, but it's hideous, isn't it?
It's an extraordinary place.
I say hideous, you say extraordinary.
Well,
okay.
I was there at a reception late one night and I was one of the last people to leave, and I walked past Tower Green where so many very fine women were beheaded at Henry's request. And I went, if I'm ever going to see a ghost, I'll see it now. I'm quite on my own. And there's the green lit by moonlight. And not a thing. I can't tell you how disappointed I was.
Oh, I thought you were going to come up with something.
I know, but I didn't.
Okay.
I really didn't.
We should say, of course, that for anyone wondering, thinking this is very... The Boleyn family had a wretched time. Everyone needs to keep in mind that the daughter of Anne Boleyn was Elizabeth I. So in the end, they had the last
laugh. It's a win.
It's a massive win.
It's a massive win for the Boleyns. And, of course, Anne Boleyn's reputation has been rehabilitated to an extraordinary degree by all the Protestant and reformist and, indeed, Victorian historians who came after then.
The brilliant historical author, writer of such epic Tudor tales and books from many other periods of history as well, we should say, Philippa Gregory, talking about her latest bestseller, which focuses on the life and times of Jane Boleyn, and that book is called Boleyn Traitor. Now, the surge in small boat crossings has been well documented, but new data offers the clearest picture of just how dangerous these journeys have become. The Times news reporter Emma Yeomans tracked emergency call logs to French aid workers and unearthed the reality of making the choice to cross. On today's The Story podcast, Luke Jones spoke to Emma about what that data revealed.
For each log, what we now have is a GPS coordinate, time, date, and number of people in the boat.
Mm.
And it's given us a very interesting but also very frightening insight into how these crossings have got more dangerous.
As you sifted through, what was the thing that jumped out of you most?
The first thing we did was we plotted them on a map, which proved strongly what we had been suspecting from on-the-ground reporting for some time, which is that as police presence has increased and the effectiveness of the police at stopping crossings in the beaches around Calais and Dunkirk has gone up, they are moving further and further south.
Which means a longer journey across
Much
the channel.
Longer. It can be three times as long.
Oh, wow.
If Calais to Dover, the sort of shortest route, is maybe a 3-4 hour journey on a good day, we're talking 12 hours plus at sea to get all the way. It's truly frightening. So that was the first thing that stood out to us, was that as we had suspected but not been able to prove, the crossings were moving further and further south and spreading out, becoming much more geographically disparate. And the second was that the number of people in each boat was going up drastically, just a steady, steady rising number, which again increases the danger because they're so overcrowded.
Mm.
You talk to volunteer rescuers and they'd look at a boat and say, that should probably hold maybe 10, 15 people, and it will have 80.
Wow. Tell us about a boat that you've seen with far too many people in. I mean, what does it look like?
Mm. So the boats themselves follow a fairly standard construction. In the early days of crossings, they were actually proper commercially made boats, you know, little ribs that you might buy from a boating store or an outdoor store. Now they are custom made for the smugglers, as far as we understand. They're being built in Turkey and in China and shipped over specifically for smugglers, and they are very poorly made.
Mm.
Even back in 2021, I remember them being increasingly poorly made. The standard construction is you get a sort of U-shaped inflatable hull, Someone described it to me once as feeling like a bouncy castle. Same kind of material, same kind of quality. Between the two sides of that U-shape, you have a sheet plastic floor.
It's not even like a sort of semi-rigid boat where it's a sort of a hard plastic or similar bottom, but with an inflatable edge. This is all flimsy plastic, basically.
Yeah. If the smugglers are feeling generous, they'll put some plywood sheets on the floor to make it a bit more rigid, but a lot of the time they don't. And then the one rigid part of the boat is the transom. So this is a wooden board at the very back of the boat that separates those two inflatable arms, keeps the two sides of the hull separate. And that gives it all of its stability, and that's what the motor attaches to.
You said that this data was distress calls. I mean, what kind of information was in the data about how far these journeys might have got, or I don't know, why they're in distress?
Some of the calls come from quite a long way out in the channel, right over into the English side or even close to English beaches. The majority are very close to the French coast. And we know that for every incident that gets to the UK and gets rescued in the UK, there are far more that we don't really hear about very much. If you go through releases and announcements from something called the Maritime Préfecture, which is a French government department responsible for affairs at sea, what's really shocking is the sheer numbers that the French are rescuing on their side. It's not uncommon for the French to pull 100 people from sea in a day, sometimes in a single incident. I think I found one week where I added up all of the announcements and there were more than 600 people rescued out of the sea in a single week.
Well, that was the Times' Emma Yeoman speaking to Luke Jones. And you can hear more on The Story podcast. One story told in depth every day, available for free wherever you listen to podcasts. It's Times Radio and it's now 3 minutes to four.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programs and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
So just to mark your card, that was before half past three. What am I talking about? After half past three, we talked to Philippa Gregory and her latest novel. Honestly, if you love a historical novel, you will absolutely devour her latest, Berlin Traitor. Tomorrow, we are live from Cheltenham from the Literature Festival. And our guest is Penny Lancaster, loose woman, special constable, former model and current presenter of any number of life-improving activities. She's also married to Rod Stewart. So, look, it's not going to be boring. That'll be tomorrow afternoon. You can hear us live from the festival. And then Penny is with us after half past three. Here's John.
Across the UK,
on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thanks, Jen. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. And here are the headlines. Dominic Cummings tells the Times that China obtained vast amounts of classified government information over several years and officials covered it up. And the Prime Minister has confirmed the government will publish in full the evidence submitted for the collapsed spying prosecutions of two men. And coming up, Times political editor, the UK's former national security advisor, joining me to discuss these stories, these revelations around China and what it means for Westminster and politics. And could we soon see driverless cars on London streets?
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Tom Noonan.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. Dominic Cummings has claimed China has compromised the system used to transfer highly secret data around Whitehall. Boris Johnson's former senior adviser has exclusively told The Times Beijing has obtained vast amounts of classified government information over many years. Mr. Cummings says he and Boris Johnson found this out in 2020. The government has been approached for comment. The Prime Minister has announced the government will publish the evidence it submitted to the China spy case in full. Prosecutions against two men collapse, which ministers have blamed on how the previous Conservative government viewed the threat posed by China. Keir Starmer told MPs at Prime Minister's questions that Kemi Badenoch was one of those responsible.
Mr. Speaker, it doesn't end there, Mr. Speaker. In September 2024, the leader of the opposition said this, I quote, "I have shied away from calling China a threat." He is playing politics with national security.
The leader of the opposition says the Prime Minister misconstrued her words. A former funeral director in Hull has denied 30 counts of preventing a lawful and decent burial of a body. 47-year-old Robert Bush has admitted 35 counts of fraud and one charge of fraudulent trading in relation to funeral plans. He's due to go on trial next year. Israel says it will not compromise on the return of dead hostages after saying one of the bodies returned by Hamas is not one of the Israeli captives. Shosh Bedrosian, a spokesperson for the Israeli Prime Minister, says Hamas should have returned all the bodies on Monday.
We will not compromise on this, and we will spare no effort until our fallen hostages return, every last one of them. Hamas agreed to release all 48 of our hostages in phase one and made the specific confirmation to President Trump, and we are expecting to see the terror organization uphold their side of this agreement.
The Israeli government has cut some aid deliveries to Gaza in response to the delays. Hamas has asked for more time, and the Red Cross says returning the bodies will take time because of the rubble in Gaza. The government has announced a raft of new sanctions against Russian oil. The new measures target the two biggest Russian oil companies, Lukoil and Rosneft, as well as companies which help deliver Russian oil to the global market. Putin critic Bill Browder, who used to be the biggest foreign investor in Russia, told Times Radio the biggest help to Ukraine now will be giving them the money from frozen Russian assets.
They don't need millions of men on the front line. They need drones. In order to get those drones, they need money to produce them. They need long-range missiles. In order to get those long-range missiles, the United States is no longer giving them. They have to buy them. So, of course, Ukrainians have all sorts of issues. But at the end of the day, money solves many problems, and it will solve a lot of problems now for the Ukrainians if they get this money.
And Angela Rayner has accepted almost £17,000 in severance pay, despite voting to ban such payments. The former Housing Secretary and Deputy Prime Minister was forced to resign after underpaying stamp duty on her seaside flat in Hove by £40,000. A spokesperson says that isn't considered a serious breach of the ministerial code, which will be the bar to preclude ministers claiming exit payments under new rules. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Well, now Keir Starmer has agreed, he's been driven to agree to publish crucial evidence in the collapsed Spying for China trial to prove that his government didn't nobble the case to avoid a row with China. The row has escalated. The political stakes, they could now scarcely be higher. just have a look. Have a look now at The Times, because you'll see a report on the front page that the Tory leader and a former Whitehall and Intelligence Service mandarins are wrangling about whether and when China was deemed a threat to this country. And while that is going on, The Times reports sensational claims by Dominic Cummings that China obtained vast amounts of highly secret information over years and that the leak was covered up. They're claims by Boris Johnson's old top aide, Dominic Cummings. And we'll have more on that breaking story in just a moment. If it seemed clear that China was being seen as a threat and has been for years under the last government as well as the present one, it's surely beyond all doubt now. And meanwhile, does anyone anywhere still believe it's a pure coincidence that a criminal case against two men accused of spying for China, that case collapsed at the same time the government is keen to stay on China's good side and keep doing business with the second largest economy in the world? Anyone? Well, Keir Starmer clearly believes that. Clearly, at any rate, he believes he can argue the government didn't undermine the spying case for political reasons. He's a lawyer, after all. Often seems more like a lawyer than a politician. But as a politician and a prime minister, if he loses this argument, and it is somehow proved that his government sank the spy trial to appease China and then tried to cover it up, Starmer is finished. Has Starmer, as a lawyer and a politician, ever had a tougher case to prove? When three former heads of the civil service, two former heads of MI6, a former director of public prosecutions, and a former national security advisor all deny the China spying case had to be dropped because China wasn't considered an enemy or a threat before 2023, were the alleged spies? Did their alleged spying? Well, the government's alibi looks more full of holes than a Swiss cheese, doesn't it? One of these cabinet secretaries, Lord Butler, for goodness sake, he's maybe the most respected of all of them. He used the Mandarinate cliche, economical with the truth. And just look at the way the government and the Crown Prosecution Service are now pointing to each other, insisting in perfect unison they did it. Well, but look at that. You can be sure on today's programme. So now the PM has agreed to publish that witness statement. We'll see what that has to say. The formerly obscure, now famous Deputy National Security Advisor, Matthew Collins, he's going to be the name on that statement. And did the statement deny the Crown Prosecution Service the testimony that it needed in court that China was deemed a threat? Or did it somehow maybe obscure that crucial question? Starmer, he must have had some reason for sounding so confident in the Commons. He accused the Tory leader, Kemi Badenoch, of making baseless accusations. She said the whole thing stinks of a cover-up. Now, the law has changed under Labour. The next spying case may well be more straightforward, but this row matters a lot. It is a row Starmer simply cannot afford to lose. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, and tell me what you think, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Now, in a moment, I'm going to catch up with the Times political editor Steve Swinford, about those allegations from Dominic Cummings that China stole classified state secrets. But first, let's just listen back to how the Prime Minister and that exchange with Kemi Badenoch at Question Time played out. So despite protests,